Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we have our justice correspondent with us, Ian Millhiser, who's the justice editor at Think Progress. Thank you for coming.
He's also,
You're going to get it right this time?
He's also, would you not jinx me like that? Come on.
Oh, come on. Ian. You got to be able to do it with the Sword of Damocles.
He is also the author of... what is it? Injustices?
Yes. Now you're screwing it up again.
It's injustices.
Yes, injustices.
Right?
Keep
then
going.
And there's a colon.
Yes,
there's
there is a colon. Big colon. It's important
and
colon.
Following that colon is the part that I usually screw up. So maybe the fact that I couldn't even remember that your book was called Injustices means I'll get the rest of it right. The Supreme Court's history of comforting the comfortable and afflicting the afflicted.
Boom.
Yes.
Bam. Got
all of that is after the colon. Yes. And it is available, by the way, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Pals, all major booksellers.
Go
now
out and
in
buy
paperback
it now.
With a new epilogue, I will add.
You know, it's actually on my summer reading list. Would you believe that?
So you're telling me that you haven't read my book yet?
I was spinning it in a positive way, which is that I have concrete plans to read your book.
I have concrete plans to borrow it after she's read it.
Tracy, you got to buy your own copy.
You know what? You're right. I'm going to buy my own. Everyone out there should buy their own. Support Ian. Injustices.
I'm going to make tens of dollars in royalties.
But, you know, the one sad thing, though, is that this book doesn't include anything about Scalia because... that has been a historical thing for this entire year. Just the blocking of Merrick Garland, all of that. Like, actually, we brought you on to talk about the roundup of the Supreme Court cases, but what the hell's going on with Merrick Garland? Can you break down for us?
I mean, what the hell is going on with Merrick Garland's like a pretty good summary of what all the press coverage has been, because nothing's happening. I mean, Dahlia Lithwick actually wrote a really good piece about how like there's a bunch of reporters who want to cover it, but it's just been such a nothing burger because the Senate Republican stance has been nope, we're not going to give you a hearing. Nope, we're not going to pay attention to you. Nope, we're not going to give you a vote.
And the couple of you out there who might not know why I brought this up, this is Obama's nominee to replace Scalia on the Supreme Court. And right now we have only 8 justices.
Right. That's exactly
but
right.
But hashtag we need 9.
That's correct.
You like how I worked that hashtag?
Well done, yes. Right?
I verbally hashtag sometimes, Ian. It's something I do.
We all do it every now and then.
Do we?
I only do it ironically.
What was I doing? Do you think that was like mice? Never mind.
I think you were in earnest there.
So no hearings, but wasn't it the American Bar? So some. Right. Reputable legal folks said that he's perfect, basically.
Yeah. The American Bar Association put out a report that was more of a love letter than it adored. I mean, literally the phrase, he may be the perfect human being, did appear in this report that the ABA came. I mean, Garland is a very well-respected judge. You know, he's more of a centrist than I think most people would like, but he's brilliant and he's been around for a really, really long time. He's very highly regarded. And under normal circumstances, it would be shocking that he wouldn't get – I mean, that they wouldn't be confirmed, much less that he wouldn't get a vote or a hearing. What worries me is that this is probably the new normal. You know, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has indicated that he will not – he may not confirm anyone that Hillary Clinton nominates if she is elected.
Can we actually dig into that for a second?
Sure.
So the at least the purported rationale, right from Republicans who have refused to hold a hearing while still calling Democrats obstructionists for sit-ins about, you know, like the House's refusal to do anything about gun violence prevention. Right. But hey, you know, details. But the purported rationale for those who have refused to give Merrick Garland a hearing has been that it's a president who's on his way out.
Right.
And so what we need to do is wait for the election, and that once we have an election, then it will make sense to do this because the next president should make this choice.
Right.
Now, that's a lot of BS for reasons that you and others, Ian, here at CAP and at Think Progress have shown in terms of looking at the numbers and the number of times that, you know, we've been in exactly this situation and it has not been a controversy at all. To say that they wouldn't give a hearing to or wouldn't confirm a nominee appointed by Hillary Clinton once elected totally exposes that bullshit rationale, fake rationale for what it is, right?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, about a third of all U.S. presidents have had a Supreme Court justice confirmed in an election year. The last one was President Ronald Reagan. So this isn't exactly an unusual
occurrence. His holiness.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what Mitch McConnell has said is he was asked, okay, well, if your rationale is that this president shouldn't get confirmed, will you guarantee that the next president will get – there'll be a hearing and a vote? And he said he wouldn't guarantee that. He later said, you know, bring it all – everything comes back to guns, Rebecca.
These days it does.
He yep. later said that one of the reasons that he wouldn't give Garland a hearing was because the NRA didn't support Garland. So now apparently the NRA has a veto power over who gets to be on the Supreme Court.
Just amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's really going on here is this. You know, ever since really the early years of the Obama administration, the GOP realized it was losing ground in the electorate. They've lost 5 of 6 presidential elections. The polls for the 7th election coming up don't look so good for them. And the Supreme Court was their firewall. That's why they sued to stop Obamacare twice. That's why they sued to stop a lot of Obama's immigration policies. You know, that is what they are counting on in order to hold the lines that they can still push their agenda forward. And if they lose the Supreme Court, they lose that important foothold. And so they are willing to, you know, and at this point, if we're talking about years and years that justice can't confirm, they're potentially destroying the Supreme Court in order to maintain their ability to potentially keep a hold on it.
Well, it feels like that's consistent with a lot of conservatives' definitions of the word save, right? Perhaps in the Social Security context.
Right.
You save it by starving it.
Right, but I digress.
Yeah. And I think it's important. Like, what they're doing now really is an existential threat to the judiciary. Because, I mean, let's game this out. Like, let's say that a year from now we have President Hillary Clinton and we still have a Republican Senate. They still refuse to confirm anyone. She serves an entire term. No one is confirmed. And there's, by the way, there's 3 other justices who are quite elderly. So by the end of that term, there could potentially be 4 vacancies on the Supreme Court. Now, let's say that she loses her election. And the next president, you know, President Nikki Haley or whoever comes in.
Do you have to say things like that?
I know.
We're going to let you roll with this odd fantasy, but go ahead.
You know, so like the next president comes in, they still have a Republican Senate. They get to fill people to those seats. Now, if you're a Democratic governor, if you're a future Democratic president, and you know that the only reason why the makeup of the Supreme Court is the way it is because of those tactics, why should you be bound by their decision? You know, the Supreme Court's legitimacy doesn't flow from its ability to, you know, bring down agents with guns upon you. If you know, it flows from the fact that people voluntarily recognize that courts have legitimacy, and what they are doing is such an attack on the inherent legitimacy of the court that it threatens making it an unviable arbitrator of American law.
So this is serious. This is a hashtag we need 9. And it's just, it's sad that
that was an earnest use of verbal hashtag.
Definitely no irony there.
Because it's just, the sad part is that, I mean, one, it's so transparent, but they're almost sloppy about this. They almost just don't care that they're caught, that we know what they're doing, that the fact that, as Rebecca was outlining, if they're waiting for President Clinton and still going to obstruct. Well, my favorite part of all this mess, I think it was Senator Orrin Hatch, who a letter, well, I think it was him, was published after it was about his meeting with Mayor Garland, but it was published before he actually met with him. So it showed that he was already had a canned response that, you know, he's a great guy, but we just need to continue and blah, blah, blah. It's like, you didn't even meet with him. You guys are just so sloppy.
Right.
Yeah. So, but so we hashtag need 9, but right now we have 8.
Right.
And we heard, we got to see some pretty major decisions with these 8. Over the past week and a half, couple weeks. So we wanted to talk with you a bit about the implications of these cases and what they really mean. I think one of the big ones that we were cheering down the halls for was Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. Is that how you say it?
I believe that's right.
They're irrelevant now at this point, but it's Whole Women's Health. In a 5-3 decision, the court upheld a woman's right to choose.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, this is hugely significant because it takes away the strongest weapon that abortion opponents had in the legal doctrine that existed before this case. And it did it largely because of anti-abortion groups' own hubris. So what?
Which almost makes it even more beautiful.
It really is lovely
as an observer.
Yeah, watching them fall on their own sword, it was just delightful.
So break down this undue burden stuff for us. What does that mean?
Sure. So our abortion law in this country has really been a mess of unclarity for a long time. So in 1992, this is where this term undue burden comes from. The Supreme Court handed down a case called Casey. Casey actually significantly weakened the right to choose. And it said that the new standard, which was a standard that was developed by the Reagan administration in the 1980s, is that the only circumstances where a state can't regulate or restrict abortion is if doing so would impose an undue burden on a significant number of women's ability to obtain an abortion. And if that phrase sounds vague to you, that's because it is. And so what happened is in the lower courts where you had conservative judges who were inclined against the right to choose, they, you know, read undue burden very narrowly because it's not a very clear phrase and it plausibly can be read very narrowly. The second important thing that happened is that in 2007, there was a case where the Supreme Court upheld a ban on a particular form of abortion. It was a rarely used procedure that was considered to be the safest way of performing abortions under certain circumstances. And the important part of that case is Justice Kennedy wrote this line in the majority opinion where he said, "Where if there's medical uncertainty, the court will typically defer to the legislature in resolving, you know, whether this really is the safest or not, or a question like that." That is the phrase that formed the basis of the Texas law. And I apologize, this has been a long explanation.
No, but, I think it's helpful to understand, even for – I feel like this is actually flashing me back to law school because I had blocked out how Casey came to be and all of this. So please, please, Ian,
no,
please.
It's easy to block out. It's good for your mental health. So in Gonzales, the court interjected this medical uncertainty language. And so what a bunch of states, including Texas, did was they took that language and ran with it. They said, well, what if we pass laws that look like health laws? You know, they look like they're trying to make abortion clinics safer. They don't actually make them safer. What they do is they make it really expensive to run an abortion clinic, and they make it really hard for doctors to get the credentials that they now need in order to perform abortions. But if you don't know much about health policy, it looks like a health law. And if anyone complains that it's not actually a real health law, then you say, oh, medical uncertainty. And, you know, maybe you introduce some expert witnesses, I'm doing scare quotes here, expert witnesses who are doctors who are against abortion will testify, well, yeah, sure, I think this will help women's health or something. And that's what Texas did here is they passed sham laws that imposed burdensome restrictions on clinics that were dressed up as health regulations. And the question in whole women's health was whether Texas could get away with that.
I'm just diving into some of those. So one of the regulations was having permitting privileges at a hospital, correct?
For admitting privileges.
Admitting privileges. So essentially, if a patient of theirs was in bad health and needed to go to the hospital, they'd need to maintain their admitting privileges by continuing to have patients in those hospitals. But abortions are so safe that that's irrelevant, so they couldn't maintain those privileges, correct?
Yeah. So admitting privileges are, you know, a hospital just means that, like, you are the doctor who has the power to sign the form that says this person is now admitted to the hospital. It's not a credential that really means all that much. You know, if someone is treated by a doctor who does not have admitting privileges at the hospital and they have some sort of complication that requires them to go to a hospital, it's not like the ambulance says, oh, we're not going to come pick you up because your doctor doesn't have admitting privileges. You know, when you show up at the emergency room, they don't turn you away. It's just just that a different doctor's signature will eventually appear on a form somewhere.
But it sounds like something that could, with the right inflection and cadence, be a common sense protection for women's health.
Exactly. And the trick here is that it is, you know, and you alluded to this, Tracy, it is actually very difficult for many abortion providers to get admitting privileges in hospitals, sometimes because the hospital itself is run by people who are anti-abortion. They just refuse to give it. But another reason is that typically a hospital isn't going to go to the trouble to give a doctor admitting privileges unless that doctor admits a certain quota of patients every year. And as you said, abortions are actually so safe that they almost never result in complications. There was one clinic that was impacted by this law that performed something like 17,000 abortions and never had a case where a woman had to go to the hospital. And so the abortion providers can't get admitting privileges because they're never going to admit anyone.
Because everything is on the up and up because it is a healthy procedure.
Yeah, so it's amazing.
So it's I think you said this in one of your articles covering this, but essentially this law was a solution in search of a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But I mean, like, I actually find, and then I know we need to move on to the Fisher case, I actually find the comparison incredibly, again, timely. Mm-hmm. It all comes back to guns. But sometimes people have sort of held up side by side how easy it is to get a gun in many states compared with how hard it is to get an abortion.
Right.
And that is just, to me, an incredibly stark contrast.
Or for that matter, how hard it is to get birth control.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
I mean, right, yeah. if you really don't like abortion, I know a surefire way to keep them from happening.
It's called abstinence-only education, right? No, I know that one.
I definitely want to get to the Fisher case, but I actually think you set up a good segue.
We're never going to get to the Fisher case, Tracy. No.
The Voisin versus United States, because that's one that hasn't gotten that much attention.
Okay.
And which is remarkable, especially in the wake of all of the, I guess, filibustering and sit-ins that members of Congress have been doing, but also this, I guess, growing national movement against gun violence in the wake of Orlando. But this, can you break down what this was and why it's such a big deal?
Sure. So this dealt with a genuinely difficult question of criminal law that, you know, fortunately, I think came out in a way that's going to be very helpful for a lot of women, which is there is a federal law which says that if you have been convicted of a crime of domestic violence, you don't get to have a gun. And I think there's perfectly sensible reasons why we want the law. The case dealt with a very technical question of whether this particular state law, which allowed a conviction of domestic violence on the basis of what's called recklessness, meaning that you didn't necessarily intend to hurt someone, it just happened, whether that counts. And there was a lot of complexities to it, but the punchline is that a majority of the court, 6-2, said that that does count. So less people who have domestic violence victims will now get to have guns. I think the most disturbing thing that was said in the case was there was a dissenting opinion, and part of it Justice Sotomayor joined, but the part that she did not join from Justice Thomas said that he was really, really concerned with the Second Amendment rights of people with domestic violence convictions. And like,
he,
you know,
just gets worse and worse.
Yeah, like
every day.
Yeah, which is it's an insane view. I mean, you know, Heller, the opinion Justice Scalia wrote that sort of created this revolution in Second Amendment law, where now it could be used to blow up all our gun laws. You know, he was very clear that like there are protections for against dangerous criminals having guns. And, you know, the notion that there is a special Second Amendment right. And what Thomas said was, well, there's never a case where someone gets a misdemeanor conviction and that leads to them losing a constitutional right, which is not true. You could actually be jailed if you have a misdemeanor conviction, which means that a whole lot of your constitutional rights, like, sort of,
you know,
float
to
away
be, to
for
be
a while.
To be anywhere,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To like, you know, be where you want to be when you want to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, you know, it was a shocking position, mm-hmm. I think, for a Supreme Court justice to take. And, you know, I'm glad because, you know, what all the research on guns show you know, as much news attention as we get from mass shootings and like events where it's clearly someone planned out a terrible murder and carried it out, that is not what most gun murders look like. You know, about half of gun murders happen because of an argument. You know, they happen because two people are fighting. One of them happens to have a gun. They you know, whether it's in a bar, whether it's spousal abuse, and one of the best predictors of whether someone is going to commit a gun, is going to commit a gun murder, is whether they have a domestic violence conviction. So I mean, this is an entire community that has been identified as having problems with their impulse control, and at least half of gun murders aren't about someone setting out to kill someone. They are about a problem where someone gets upset and they lack the appropriate impulse control.
Well, but it fits in with the larger conversation that is happening, although not necessarily on the up and up, similar to the abortion conversation in this country, right? I mean, if you are going to oppose gun violence prevention measures, including ones that are supported overwhelmingly by majorities, large majorities of voters, as well as even majorities of NRA members and gun owners, then you are saying that you care more about someone's right to own a gun, and I'm not just talking about any gun, but like military assault weapons and like buying as much ammo as one could ever possibly fit in their house, or I guess maybe your shed or wherever. I don't know. I don't have guns. I don't know where you keep your ammo. Then you do about public safety.
Right.
And that's the choice that you're making. Yeah. And that's the valuation in terms of. But we have to move on to Fisher.
All
sorry.
Right, let's do Fisher.
Sorry, Boisine.
We have to do Fisher, which I feel like this one feels a little more lighthearted and funny to me, especially because for a full
Becky
day.
Becky
with the bad grades was trending. I mean, some of you out there might be a little offended by it, but essentially, I think everyone has experienced a Becky in their lives, and Abigail Fisher is public enemy number one, public Becky number one.
Just to be clear, I have never gone by Becky.
She's Rebecca or Becca.
When I was a child, people would sometimes try to call me Becky, and it didn't go over well, and I feel vindicated in that choice now. So I was I also didn't get bad grades.
Yeah, I was also about to say your grades were not bad.
Your grades were great.
But I have really good hair.
It's true. I always compliment her and she'll be like, I washed it. That's why.
That's true. Thanks for saying that on radio.
Just go to our website and see a beautiful picture of Rebecca Vallis, Becky Vallis.
With hair that
with
no
the
longer...
Washed, wish the washed
with the
hair.
Washed hair.
It no longer looks like me, though, because my hair is so short in that picture. And
that's
actually,
true.
I need to talk to Andrew Satter about getting a new
that's
photo.
True.
So
that's
Andrew,
true.
Andrew Satter is one of the most loyal listeners that we have of Talk Poverty Radio. Much more loyal than my parents, who will never tell me that they realized I called them out on air because they don't listen to the show. My sister does, Katie Vallis, love you. But Andrew Satter, who is our director of video, thank you for being a loyal listener, and I'm going to be reaching out to you for a new headshot.
We want to make sure that she's Rebecca with the good hair. But there was actually a USA Today, I believe it was USA Today article, they did a roundup of some of the greatest tweets making fun of Abigail Fisher. And Ian made it into it with
did
his
you
tweet,
really?
Essentially praising that hashtag as being the reason for Twitter.
I think I call it the humanity's greatest contribution to the hashtag art.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
Oh,
so
man.
Why don't you give, before we go back into some of the fun, why don't you give us an overview of what the Fisher versus University of Texas Austin was about.
Much better than your Prince tweets, by the way.
I thought my Prince tweets were all right.
Oh, they were provocative, for
I got,
sure.
I got a little bit of hate for them, undeserved.
Sorry, Fisher. Yeah. Fisher.
Okay, so Becky with the bad grades is Abigail Fisher, who is a woman who did not get into the University of Texas. She did not get into the University of Texas because she didn't have the grades to get into the University of Texas.
Hence the hashtag.
Right.
Yes.
In fact, despite the fact that she sued to challenge the affirmative action plan at the University of Texas, the evidence in this case showed that no matter what her race, she wouldn't have gotten in.
Right, because essentially her claim was, is simply put, reverse racism.
Right.
But evidence showed that there were a ton of people with grades better than her that were people of color who didn't get in.
Right.
But also that out of the people who had similar grades to or lower or similar grades to her that did get in, only 5 were people of color.
And like 42.
And 42 were white.
Right.
And I think so it was like 4 Latinos, 1 African-American and 42 white people. But it was those 5 people of color that got in that were to blame for her mediocre self not getting in.
So, like, to, you know, I guess to explain what we're talking about here when we talk about this affirmative action program, because I think it's useful to understand, like, how affirmative action actually operates now. You know, it's not a quota system. That's been unconstitutional since the 1980s. And in this case, what she challenged was actually rather tiny. So what she challenged was that the overwhelming majority of the students who are admitted to the University of Texas, now it's 75%, get in through what's called the top 10% program. So if you're in the top 10% of your class, now I think it's down to like 7 or 8%, you automatically get into the University of Texas, regardless of which Texas high school you go to. She was not in the top 10%. She did not get in that way. And then there is another group, which is called the holistic admissions group, where you look at the full range of grades, test scores, college essay, extracurriculars, you know, all the things that you normally think of schools looking at. And one of the factors there is that a tiny part of the consideration is whether the person would add racial diversity to the school. The reason for that, and this is what the Supreme Court said several years ago in the Grutter case, is because everyone at a school benefits from a more diverse campus. You know, when you go out into the workforce, you're going to interact with people who do not look like you. And so your education will be poorer if you don't, if you aren't in an educational environment where you get to learn from their experience and they get to learn from yours. And so that is why, you know, diversity, you know, the school has some ability to take some steps to increase the racial diversity on campus. But in practice, the way that it worked is that you had two qualified people, you had one slot, and one of it had to go to someone. And if one of them would add racial diversity, that could often be the tiebreaker. It wasn't something that was deciding a huge amount of who gets in. This is what was challenged. And I think most people were, including me, were really pessimistic about affirmative action's chances coming into this. This court was two justices down because it wasn't just down Scalia. It was down Justice Kagan, who's an Obama appointee. She was recused. Justice Kennedy, who is the closest thing that the court has to a swing vote on race, had never in his entire career on the court voted to uphold an affirmative action plan. And surprise, this was the first one. It was a very narrow opinion. I think that it leaves a lot of room for opponents of affirmative action, frankly, to harass schools that want to engage, who want to continue to have affirmative action programs with new suits. But it is much more of a victory than I think anyone expected for affirmative action, because I think people thought this was going to be the case that killed it, and it turned out not to be.
So I didn't read the opinion because I have friends like you who do it for me. So what grounds did Kennedy decide to finally, I guess, vote in favor of an affirmative action case?
So he accepted the diversity argument in principle that, like, you know, diversity does bring these benefits. Part of the reason
Which is not a small deal at all.
Yeah. Right. But like part of the reason why he signed on to this particular plan is because of the smallness of it, for all the reasons
that
I just described.
Race is almost a footnote in the decision. But there's a wide array of criteria taken into consideration.
And so Kennedy felt that the university had adequately demonstrated that they did everything they could to foster diversity. And after that, they realized it still wasn't enough. And so they did, you know, just a little bit more in order to reach better diversity goals. And he thought in those circumstances that was enough. I think the most troubling part of the opinion for supporters of affirmative action is he refers to an ongoing obligation that universities have to, like, constantly be reevaluating to make sure that they still need the plans that they
leaving
have.
Leaving it open for you can continuously challenge
these
laws to see if they're still relevant, or these admissions practices to see if they're still relevant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's what the danger is.
So, like, now that we've had a black president, right, we live in a post-racism world, and so we don't need those anymore, right?
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's what they taught us in diversity training.
Just kidding. They didn't. That wasn't said. That was not said at all. all. In fact, the opposite is true.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that's virtually what the Supreme Court said in its opinion striking down the Voting Rights Act. I mean, you know, you have some people who believe some in a very hard line way, some very naive things about racism and whether it exists in the United States or whether it exists enough to actually do anything about it.
I think actually, so that's why, you know, back to my favorite hashtag, and I guess and yours too, the Becky with the bad grades, is that
you love saying that.
I love it. Just rolls relishing off the tongue it. For me is that she was someone who had also been admitted to another University right. of Texas campus and was going to be allowed to complete 1 year, really 9 months because right. the school year, and then transfer to University of Austin. University of Texas at Austin. She chose not to do that. Also, she's been out of college for a yeah. while now, and is just,
yeah. The case should have been declared moot because right. yeah, there's nothing really at stake anymore. She was suing, I think, to get her application fee back or something
right.
like
right.
that.
It was something minuscule like that. Yeah. But I think that Twitter had a field day with, I guess, the level of entitlement that she was demonstrating, because I think when she was interviewed, she said, you know, my family had gone, you know, right. everyone in my family, this was a tradition. And it's like, well, it sucks that you didn't have the grades to continue yeah. the tradition.
It's too bad that your parents had a tradition of getting better grades than you did.
So in the last 2 minutes that we have with you, Ian, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever been able to contain yourself to just 2 minutes.
I'll do my best.
Here is that opportunity and challenge. You mentioned, you know, to some extent the role that not having nine played mm-hmm. in causing people to assume that actually the Fisher case was going to turn out differently.
Right.
There is a case where because we didn't have nine, we had a 4-4 tie, yeah. and it was a particularly important case, and that was U.S. versus Texas, yeah. And sort of more colloquially known as the DACA-DAPA case.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that quickly, and why it's an illustration yeah. of why we need a ninth justice.
Yeah. No, this is really tragic. I mean, so you have this is the challenge to President Obama's no longer recently announced his immigration yeah. policies that he announced in 2014 that would have led about 4 to 5 million undocumented immigrants remain in the country, would have given them the ability to no longer work in a shadow economy that depresses everyone's wages, but instead, you know, to come out and live openly and work openly. And it's very clearly established in existing law that this is something that the president and the executive branch has the power to do. I was very optimistic going into this argument that Roberts and Kennedy were going to vote to uphold it, because in 2012 they wrote, or Kennedy wrote and Roberts joined, an opinion emphasizing the broad discretion that the executive branch has to decide whether to bring immigration proceedings at all against someone who is eligible to be removed from the country. And they did not seem to have read their own opinions at that oral argument. And we wound up with a 4-4 split, which means that the very conservative lower court, which struck the programs down, is at least for now upheld and will remain in effect until we get a ninth justice confirmed.
And there's 4 million undocumented Americans who are now at risk for deportation in a way that DACA and DAPA would have protected them.
I mean, some of it is at risk for deportation, although one thing, fortunately, the lawsuit did not touch is the administration's ability to set priorities. But the problem is that it forces them into the shadows.
Right.
Where
they lose that path to legal status.
And not just to legal status, but they lose the ability to work in the same economy with the same regulations that everyone else has, where they not only have the opportunity to reach for better jobs themselves, but they are not essentially diminishing everyone's wages because they're working right. in a shadow economy where there isn't a minimum wage and there isn't all of the mm-hmm. protections that every worker is supposed to have.
Ian Millhiser, who authored a book that needs to not be named any further, but also, and more importantly, perhaps—
It has a colon.
We now know that, right?
Google Ian Injustices. Well, I don't know what will come up if you make it that simple.
I wonder what would come up.
Ian Millhiser's
Injustices. Wow, that's another episode. But also our
I don't think people want to see that episode.
Also our justice correspondent for Talk Poverty Radio and also justice editor at Think Progress. Ian, thank you for joining us
for
this
for
Supreme
me.
Court roundup.
We'll have you back soon.
So, Tracy, now we're headed into the next installment of our summer book series. So, listeners, stay tuned for a re-airing of our interview with Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
And we are extremely pleased to be joined by Matthew Desmond, Harvard sociologist and author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
And so before we, you know, dive into some of the content of your book, can you just explain a little bit about what led you to Milwaukee and to cover evictions?
You know, I'd always been really troubled by the amount of poverty in this country, you know, the fact that America is really unmatched by any wealthy democracy for the depth and expanse of its poverty. And I wanted to figure that out, and I wanted to see how housing was playing a role in driving poverty in our cities. I chose Milwaukee because I wanted to write a book that had a shot at representing a broader American experience. A lot of the books on poverty are being written on the margins, you know, either focusing on some of the cities that we consider our biggest successes, like New York or San Francisco, or some of the cities that some people say are our biggest failures, like Camden or Detroit. I think Milwaukee gives us an opportunity to write about experiences that are like those in Kansas City and Indianapolis and Cleveland. So it is a book that's really set in Milwaukee, but it tells a larger national story.
And in order to sort of take a very close and personal look at the issue of eviction, how it impacts individuals, families, communities, you actually embedded yourself within the communities, the low-income communities who experience eviction at such alarming rates. Tell us a little bit about the way in which you sort of committed ethnography for this book.
Right. So I decided if I wanted to understand the role that eviction was playing in people's lives, and also why landlords evict people and how they go about their business, which is a really important part of the book, I decided that I needed to see it up close and personal. So I moved into a trailer park on the far south side of Milwaukee, and I rented a trailer and I lived there for several months. And then I moved into a rooming house on the north side of the city, which is the traditional inner city, the predominantly African-American part of the city. And I lived there for about 10 months. And from those two neighborhoods, I met several families going through eviction. And I went to eviction court with them. I watched their kids, slept at their houses. If they left Milwaukee, I left with them. I followed them into trailer parks and into abandoned houses and shelters, and generally tried to get as close to their everyday lives as I could. I went to things like funerals and counseling sessions and even a birth. But I also knew that if I really wanted to understand the connection between housing and poverty, I needed to understand the landlord's perspective. So if you were getting evicted, I wanted to get just as close with your landlord doing the evicting. So I did. And so the book also covers landlords. And I watched them buy properties, sell properties, evict you, but not me. I kind of understood what makes them tick, how much money they make, and tried to kind of write about this problem from that point of view as well.
And digging a little bit into the landlords, because that was part of what was especially fascinating to me in reading this book. You start with, you actually open the book with Sharina Tarver.
Right.
Many of the names have been changed and you use pseudonyms, but she's a former teacher turned, as you call her, an inner city entrepreneur who really has made quite a living renting to poor Black residents in Milwaukee. But that chapter really has the effect of humanizing her. Simultaneously, we're getting introduced to her tenants, some of whom she's actually in the process of evicting, but we really see her as much of a human character, and in some ways even sympathetic, almost as much so as we do some of the individuals that are her tenants. Why start the book off that way from the perspective of a landlord?
I feel that, you know, poverty isn't just about people that don't have a lot of money or about neighborhoods that are characterized by high poverty rates. It's relationship. It involves rich people and non-rich people alike. It involves landlords and tenants alike. And I think that I wanted to try to write a book that was broader, in a sense, and included the stories and perspectives of people that were not poor, but were very important to the lives of low-income families. I mean, landlords literally own poor neighborhoods. You know, they dictate where people live, why they have to move, who they get to live with. And so I think that starting with the landlords was my way of saying, look, if we really want to understand poverty, we have to expand our vision beyond just poor people and poor communities. I think that, you know, your response to how I wrote about Sharina, I feel like that means that I did my job, because it is complicated. It's complicated, and we let ourselves off the hook. We don't get to have the really hard conversation if we just say, oh, these tenants, they're irresponsible, or these landlords, they're just greedy. When you really embed yourself with both parties, you find that the story is much more messier than that.
And at the same time, you really paint a picture that eviction is not just, I think, as you wrote, the period of the sentence. I think we often think that if someone is evicted, something wrong must have happened, that they did something wrong. Can you explain through some of the stories that you captured how this isn't the case and how eviction has become part of a business model in a sense?
Right. So let's talk about someone I met in Milwaukee, Arlene. So Arlene is a single mom. She was trying to raise two boys. When I met her, she was living in a rundown two-bedroom apartment, one of Sharina's apartments, in a very poor neighborhood in the fourth poor city in the country. And the rent for that apartment took 88% of Arlene's income, which at that time was a welfare check. Now, just imagine that. Just imagine that the first of the month, 88% of your income is gone. And so we might ask, well, is Arlene weird? Is that an unusual situation? And the sad response is no. We've reached a point in this country where the majority of low-income families are giving at least half of their income to housing. And about one in four of those families are paying over 70% just on rent and utilities. So in those conditions, under that extreme level of what economists call housing burden, you don't need a major life event. You don't need to make a huge mistake. You don't need to confront a car accident or a medical emergency to fall behind in rent. Something very small can do it, can tip you over. And a lot of times it goes to kind of the discretion of the landlord. So we see Arlene get evicted because one of her boys hit a car with a snowball, and the man whose car was hit kicked the door in. That leads to an eviction. We see her evicted again because the same kid had an altercation with a teacher at school, and the teacher called the police, and that got her evicted. And so, you know, in conditions where, you know, most low-income renting families are giving most of their income on housing, eviction for many is not the result of irresponsibility, but inevitability.
And another way in which you highlight that eviction is not the period full stop of this sentence is you discuss and you really show through the people's lives whom you profile in this book how eviction of one family can actually destabilize, as you put it, multiple city blocks, not only the block from which a family was evicted, but also the block to which it's begrudgingly relocated. You highlight a family that includes Doreen and Patrice, and they get evicted from a house where they're doing okay and they have enough space among eight people, but they end up having to relocate to one of Shireen's properties with eight people effectively living in a two-bedroom apartment. Talk a little bit about how eviction can have effects on not just families, but whole neighborhoods and communities.
Right. So in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Milwaukee, the eviction rate is astoundingly high. And so we know from the work of sociologists like Rob Sampson that, you know, to really, when people really invest in their communities and work together to make it better, they can make a real difference. You know, they can drive down crime. They can call for political action in their community. But that becomes impossible if people can't hang on to those communities, if those communities aren't sticky because so many people are moving in and out of them. And so we have some data from Milwaukee that shows that neighborhoods with higher eviction rates have higher violent crime rates the following year. And I think that eviction plays a big role in that. Now, when people move out of one neighborhood into the other, we know that they often move into a worse neighborhood. They're moving from a poorer neighborhood to an even poorer one. And they often relocate to substandard housing like Doreen and Patrice and the whole Hinkston family did. And so under those conditions, people don't want to invest in a new neighborhood. They don't kind of say, gosh, we're here now and let's make it better. They want to get out. They want to get out. And so eviction often in that way leads to not one move, but two. And it can destabilize families and communities several moves removed from the actual eviction. And that's just one of many consequences that follows forced displacement.
And you highlight the ripple effects of evictions in the realm of mental health as well. And you talk about the number of suicides that are attributed to evictions and foreclosures, that they in fact doubled between 2005 and 2010. You know, this is different than your typical book or reporter or study on housing in that it gets into the mental aspects of it. Can you, I guess, explain what the reactions to that aspect of your work has been like?
You know, it's a sad but very true finding an aspect of eviction, that it doesn't just have an effect on your residential instability, your material hardship, the neighborhood you live in, the kind of housing you live in does affect all those things, but it also affects your spirit, you know, your mental health. We have a study that shows that moms that were evicted have higher rates of depression 2 years later after the eviction. That has to have a enormous effect on family life, the relationship with their children, their energy level, their ability to kind of go find work. And every sheriff that I've met that is part of the eviction squad has suicide stories. You know, the story of knocking on the door and hearing a gunshot, you know, afterwards. That should disturb us. That should concern us deeply. It seems that eviction is not just affecting the home. It affects so much more than that.
And just to follow up, you know, you open in the book talking about how communities used to really rally against evictions, that you would have protests, you know, maybe up to 1,000 people or more protesting, making sure that a household didn't get evicted. What do you think shifted in our culture that we went from seeing eviction as a horrible fate to something that's in the shadows?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when you read books from the 1930s, 1940s, you know, evictions were rare and they were scandalous. You know, they drew crowds. And it hasn't always been the case that poor families in this country couldn't pay rent. You know, this is a something that's got a lot worse over the last decade, and evictions have become commonplace. You know, we have sheriff squad whose full-time job is to carry out eviction all day. We have moving companies who work from sunup to sundown, you know, pushing families out. We have literally hundreds of data mining companies that record evictions and sell that information to landlords. And so we've had a surge of eviction in recent years, and I think that maps on to the fact that incomes for low-income families have been stagnant or fallen, but housing costs have soared, not only rent, but also utilities. And public policy has failed to bridge the gap. I think most Americans that don't live in trailer parks or in the inner city still think that the typical low-income family benefits some way from public housing or housing assistance. But as you guys know, the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 families that qualify for housing assistance receive it, which is kind of unthinkable with other basic necessities like food. What if we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for food stamps? But that's exactly how we treat housing aid today. And under those conditions, eviction has become frankly commonplace in our poorest neighborhoods.
And of course, as your book really profiles in a lot of detail, it isn't just eviction. It's also the substandard conditions, that low-income renters are really forced to accept. A theme that really runs throughout your book and perhaps could even maybe be a substitute title for your book is exploitation.
So I feel that there's two questions in there. One is about the conditions people are living in. There's some good news here, and the good news is, you know, we have taken major strides in the right direction when it comes to improving low-income families' housing conditions. Just a few generations ago, slums were ravaging our cities. You know, people were living without heat and running water and ventilation. You know, babies were getting tuberculosis. There were outhouses in the middle of Philadelphia. We as a nation took on a battle with slums, and we won. And this book, and I certainly will not shy away from the fact that we still have a lot to go there. You know, when I lived in the trailer park, most of the time I didn't have hot water, even though I told the landlord, I'm a writer, I'm going to write about you and your trailer park. So just imagine what my neighbors had to endure. So we do have a long way to go here, but we've made impressive strides. So why? What's going on? Don't we have laws that protect families, you know, from living in substandard conditions? And my response to that is yes, but those laws do not reach the very bottom. Because if you are someone like Arlene, who is paying 88% of your income to rent, you're going to have to ask your landlord's compassion one day. Often you move in and you're behind because you can't pay your first and last month's rent and a security deposit. You can barely pay first month's rent. And so under those conditions, tenants really execute their rights with great risk of eviction. Landlords are forbidden to retaliate against a tenant who reports housing problems. They can at any time evict a tenant who's behind. So it's not that tenants don't know their rights. It's not that those rights don't exist. It's that they literally cost money. And tenants know that exercising those rights when they're severely rent burdened, when they're behind, when they have to ask landlords for favors, and under those conditions, those rights really become toothless. And then there's a second question about exploitation and how we think about that. And the way I came to think about that is, you know, poverty isn't just a product of low incomes. It's also a product of exploitation, you know? And we have to face the reality that there's some people that make a lot of money off poor people and poor communities. When I started this book, I wondered, you know, why would anyone, you know, rent a trailer park and own a trailer park? You know, why would you do that? Why would you buy property in the inner city and manage it? And then when I finished the book, I kind of was like, well, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? The profits are there. The profits are there if you have a stomach for that kind of work. So the landlord in the trailer park that I lived in, which at that time was considered an environmental biohazard by the city, owned 131 trailers. And I looked at his rent rolls, calculated his income by looking at his actual books, you know, so I could pay attention to things like vacancies and missed payments. There are a lot of missed payments. His mortgage records, tax records, water bill, all this kind of stuff. And I tried to get the most rigorous estimate possible, which was this landlord was taking home about $470,000 a year after expenses. That's literally a lifetime difference between him and his tenants. That's 30 times what his tenants working full-time for minimum wage were making. And it's about 50 times what his tenants receiving disability were taking in. So I think we have to confront that fact and ask, can we make a big difference when it comes to poverty in America if we don't confront the fact that that there is a business model at the bottom of every market?
And another tension that took place in the book was the fact that I think you yourself, it seemed reluctant to have to talk about the, I guess, bad things or bad choices that the people that you profiled made. So I think there was one article about your book talking about how you were frustrated that one of the people spent their food stamps on a lobster dinner. And so I would be interested in you explaining a bit about how you hope people read your book, because I get the sense that you wanted to share the real stories, but often there's this urge or this instinct people have to evaluate the behavior of the poor and that they somehow must be more moral than the rest of the country. You know, could you explain that tension a bit?
So the moment that you're talking about involved Lorraine, and Lorraine was my neighbor in the trailer park. She was a grandmother, and at the time we met, you know, she was paying over 70% of her income on rent. She received disability for a childhood accident that left her impaired, and this was a moment where she wanted to celebrate an anniversary with her deceased boyfriend, who mattered very much in her life. And she did. She took her entire allotment of food stamps and blew it on a single meal, and consisting of lobster and king crab. And you know, when I learned about that, and I want to stress that this is one instance in the book. You know, this is not something Lorraine did over and over again, and it's also not something that she did because she had too many food stamps. You know, she took it on the chin after she did that. She went hungry some nights, and she had to kind of scour food pantries and other places to receive enough food to make it to the end of the month. But she didn't apologize for that. You know, she didn't apologize. She wanted to do something special, and for that evening and that night. And I took it that was my job to really understand that, to not apologize on her behalf, and to really look that thing in the face and provide a logic for it. And the logic that I came to was, you know, Lorraine is not poor because she's making bad decisions. She's making bad decisions because she's poor, in a way. You know, there's no amount of skimping and saving that are going to pull Lorraine above the poverty line. She's living so far beneath it and giving so much of her income on housing. And under those conditions, you might as well pepper the suffering with color. You know, you might as well live fully. And that's what Lorraine did. And I thought it was my job to write about these things with as much complexity and honesty as I could. I thought ignoring those does no one a service.
In the final minute for which we have you, I would feel remiss if we didn't ask, given the nature of this sort of ethnographic work, if you could talk a little bit about how you see your role in this work. You're you know, very close to people who are almost constantly facing crisis, where in the example of Lorraine, there's a moment where she's desperately trying to come up with $150 to prevent an eviction. How did you handle situations like that where you knew you could have intervened and changed the course of these people's lives and prevented crisis, but perhaps at the expense of what others consuming your work might have viewed as the integrity of the ethnography?
I don't know if I could have changed the course of their life. You know, Lorraine paid 70% of her income every month. So if I stepped in 1 month, the first of the month for the next is coming. And I think that I always thought of myself as writing in a tradition that's deeply connected to reform. And that tradition is bearing witness to suffering. That tradition is about trying to understand people's lives from shoulder height, you know, and write about those things. My relationship with the folks in the book became organic. You know, I bought them food, they bought me food, I bought them gifts, they bought me gifts. There are some points in the book where I did intervene in a major way, and those are articulated at the end, just so readers know what happened and why I did it. But I thought that we could make a bigger difference if I tried to intervene as little as possible and instead wrote about these things in a larger way. And that's what I did. I think that I think we see this in books, especially with housing, going back to Jacob Riis, where if you can, you know, write about people's lives and show the broader American public what's really going on out there, that has a real shot at changing the public conversation and hopefully changing public policy.
We've been speaking with Matthew Desmond. He's a Harvard sociologist whose book Evicted was just released and shines a light on the reality of eviction in Milwaukee, but really across the country. He also has a website that he's started called justshelter.org. People can go there and be connected with resources either in their state or at the national level if they'd like to learn more about how they can get involved. Matthew Desmond, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my